Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Will Hamilton, who I believe is one of Australia's foremost experts on private wealth management. He's written for the wealth section of The Australian for over 10 years and has a raft of industry awards, including Top 10 Financial Advisor, the IFA Industry Thought Leader of the Year, and Top 50 Most Influential Advisors. I've known Will for over 40 years, and I respect his judgment on all matters wealth management for families and businesses with over 10 million of investable assets. Will, welcome.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolute delight. So, Will, I'm seeing a lot of founders exiting their businesses in trade sales to private equity and to management after a career building those businesses. And at that point, they're often saddled with a lump sum that they may not have had any prior experience in managing. So today, I'd like to discuss what their options really are. But before we do that, Will, tell me a bit about your wealth management journey. How did you first get interested in it, and how did that journey evolve?
Look, thanks for the question, and thank you very, very much for having me. My early days of my career, I was actually in institutional equities. So I spent some time in London, and then I ended up running Deutsche's Asian equity business. So based in Hong Kong, but across the region. So we had 16 different offices. And then children get older, and so I ended up coming back to Australia for secondary school reasons, was the major driver. And I ended up going to JB Weir. They had an ultra high net worth area, which was 30 million plus. And I ended up going into there and running that. That was a fantastic experience. That, I think, one of the reasons is, you know, knowing my knowledge of international equity markets. And through that, and then sitting on management committees at Deutsche, I became very familiar with fixed income trading, a lot of other things. So when it comes to wealth management, it's about multi-asset class. And you know, that's what I've been really interested in. That's what's driven me for our clients. And the one thing I always say is it's about purpose. And then from there, you know, JB Weir went through many different ownership changes, and I thought I wanted to get back to what I think is my skill set, and that is looking after clients.
So, Will, in the context of medium business owners and their families, what is wealth management?
It's a really good question, because we look at it at there's running the money, and that's very important. But, you know, in fact, I'm in Sydney at the moment, and I saw a client last night, and he put that performance in down at number three, which I was really interested in. He said, integrity is number one. This is what he said to me. He said, there's four things that he looks at: integrity, trust, performance, and then experience. So their experience with us as a firm. So I thought that was very interesting. That was his assessment, and he's been a client with us for probably nearly 10 years, and not insubstantial in the amount of money that we run for him. And I think that's one of the key things. So there is running the money, but there's the other side, which is what we call wealth planning. And we act as a concierge, I think, in that respect. So we've got knowledge, but we don't do those things ourselves. And when we see a need for a client, we refer on to other experts, be that estate planning, be that tax, you know, be that succession advice, governance. Those sort of things come in. We've got to be able to sit beside the client. We've got to be able to guide the client. We've got to be able to identify that need. But we don't do that ourselves. We have a network of experts where we refer on to.
Yeah, so sticking to your knitting is actually part of that integrity and trust dimension as well. Being confident and bold enough and, frankly, transparent enough to be able to sort of say, yeah, we'll run the money. This sort of stuff, like succession planning or governance, this is where you need to actually get different experts involved, and we'll support you along the way and be part of a bigger team. But that's not what we do.
Correct. And sometimes there's some difficult conversations required in some of those things as well. So you've got to be the right people that can handle those conversations.
Yeah, well, certainly in my business, in supporting, you know, business owners in helping them develop their strategic plans and then implement them, you know, one of the things that does is it exposes you to all areas of their business. And it would be very easy to turn around and say, oh, yes, I'm an expert on marketing. Oh, yes, I'm an expert on manufacturing and so on. But the reality is that would be failing the client. And it would also be actually failing myself.
Yep.
So when we then look at, okay, so we're into wealth management and wealth planning. How common an issue is this? Obviously, you've been doing it for 10 years, so you've got plenty of clients. But, you know, I'm seeing this bubbling up as a result of, you know, a number of my clients exiting, and all of a sudden they've got a pool of money that they actually don't have experience managing. Are you seeing this as a common scenario, or have I got a freaky client base?
No, you don't have a freaky client base. People talk about...
With me, so I guess, you know, there's always a risk.
No, but look, people talk about this wealth transition that's going to occur. It's not going to occur. It's occurring.
Absolutely.
And be it people selling businesses that you've just talked about and therefore looking at the next stage of their life, or even just transition of if someone's had an event many years ago and therefore the next stage of transition of that wealth where the next generation's becoming involved. So there's sort of two aspects of this, and it's occurring. And, you know, it's amazing when, you know, we sit down with people and the businesses that they've had or have and how they've made money. It's extraordinary. And I take my hat off to a lot of people. Mm. But I think the most important thing is I find, like, we had one client who came to see us and he said, I've sold my business. And I went, oh, you know, I knew that this was on the cards, but, you know, and we were in discussions with him and guiding him on that. But then suddenly he came in, I sold it. And I went, oh, really? Okay, so it's done. And I said, it's signed. He said, yes. I went, and then we got into discussions and he said, and then I've got this agreement on this with my general manager that I owe him X out of percentage out of the sale. I said, all right. And I said, so in after-tax money? Uh-huh. And he looked at me and he said, yes. I said, so you're paying his tax. And this is an example where he didn't get his business sale ready.
Yeah.
I can ask the questions. I can't provide the solutions.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not qualified to give that tax advice, but I think it's very important to make sure that a business structurally is set up for sale. And as I call it, sale ready.
Yeah.
And the business operationally.
A 3-year process.
Correct. So operationally it might be sale ready, but is it structurally sale ready? And this is an example where I don't think the I's had been dotted and the T's crossed. And that person that gives that advice to give it sale ready may not be the same person that is your day-to-day accountant either.
No.
So that's a really important thing. You know, this is one example, but you know, I've got other examples of people that have gone through, you know, another group of clients, had a professional services business, and the way they structured it to, in a very slow, structured way, get out of this onto the next generation through employee shareholder ownership plans and, you know, cocktailing this, so to speak, with people buying in, grants, vendor financing. You know, it was very impressive to see how it had been done, and they've moved on to the next level.
And I guess there's also the scenario where there's intergenerational transfer from an older generation, which might then put the recipients, the children, in a situation that they're also ill prepared for.
Yep.
How do you sort of see the intergenerational issues playing out?
That's where sometimes the succession people have to definitely get involved. You can see that. But, you know, again, there's been some other families that have done this very well. And, you know, we've got one client where we look after those that were the recipients of that, of the pass on, whereas and one generation, and one of their siblings is now running that business. But that was done in a very structured way. And you can see there's no regrets. But, you know, I take my hat off to the way that family did it in keeping family harmony. Whereas
it's not something that happens by accident. And, you know, there's a bigger picture at play always, which is, you know, how do we help ensure that when the families get together at Christmas, they're still talking to each other as opposed to arguing or having resentment, which can easily happen inadvertently.
Yeah.
And particularly when you add to that their own individual families, which can also change the dynamics.
Yeah. So I think there's plenty of stories, and you're recently, you know, today in the press is the issues the Murdoch family have gone through in Lachlan succeeding over his father, and what's happening with his brothers and sisters, with brother and sisters. That's a well documented story where, you know, I don't think they will be getting together and talking honestly around the Christmas table. As I said, this other example, I take my hat off to the fact that I think the father must have driven this, and then the siblings wanted the outcome and were agreeable to it, and they're on the same page.
Yeah. And it really, and I guess one of the things that, that comes to play here is a mindset one whereby there's a large sum of money, doesn't matter whether it's 10 or 100 or 500 million, there's a large sum of money that gets passed down to the next generation with an intent that actually they are not the recipients to burn it, but actually the stewards of it for future generations to come. And that's quite a different mindset that, again, families may be ill-equipped to understand.
So in the larger amount, with our larger clients, one of the things we talk about is using vehicles that for investing as an estate planning tool. So the end game is to pass this money on. So yes, you live off it whilst it's there, but you pass it on.
Yeah, yeah. There's always going to be families where there is no one to pass it on to.
Yeah.
And what's been your experience there? How do some of those families handle that sort of an issue?
So philanthropy is an important part for families, whether they've got it to pass on or not. And that's an area where you need to have these discussions with people with, you know, and make sure this is set up. You can't rule from the grave.
No.
But also, you know, there's, again, advisors in this area that we bring in. And, you know, we had a dinner on this very subject in June in Melbourne.
Mm.
And, you know, that need to look to set up, you know, be it a PAF or, you know, setting this up through a will to pass on and do that responsibly without there being a fight at the end. But also, if that's the case, can you get some enjoyment from doing that before you die as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. It shouldn't just be a burden that's carried for the next generation.
Correct.
So Will, take me through a case study, if you will, of a client coming to you with the challenge of what to do with their new investable assets and how they might go about that process and what they've done.
Yeah. So, look, we have a discussion with them about what their needs and wants are. And, you know, we're not right for everybody. You've got to admit. And, you know, I think that, as I say to clients, after family, this is a very, very important part of their life. So they've got to be able to work with us. So you've got to be able to, you know, choose your advisor on who you think you can best work with. Mm. And that's really important. So are we the right fit? If we are, then we do an investment proposal. But before we do that, we ask them to do a risk profile, which is required by law, but ours is a little bit different. It's got an embedded psychometric test in there.
Mm-hmm.
We disclose that to every client. No client's ever said no.
Mm.
But the reason why we disclose this is we're going to know, you know, a little bit more about this prospective client, which we give them a copy of. So we're going to know their biases. We're going to know their stress points, especially, you know, because markets do go down as well as up.
Yeah.
And so we can best service them. And I think that's a really important thing. And I can have the right individual servicing them as well. Because, you know, our team have, everyone's got different personalities as well.
Yeah.
And we then look at working with their team. So they've got, you know, clients have teams of lawyers, they've got teams of accountants, et cetera. So what are the entities? And, you know, superannuation was always reasonably simplistic until recently.
Mm.
And, you know, Division 296 is now up in the air. What is going to happen? Well, the Financial Review and the Australian are speculating that it's all up in the air again, so given that legislation that was for the House of Representatives lapsed. So what are we going to use superannuation for? What type of assets, given the tax nature of it? We need to get some clarity on that. Then are there family trusts? Is there an element of the money that needs to be run more income generating, whilst the other component might be more growth oriented? Are there various family members? So we just had a discussion about, you know, intergenerational. So are there other family members that come into this as well?
Mm.
And their growth profile, or the risk profile, sorry, is probably quite different from mum and dad.
Yeah.
Likewise, are there the needs for, are there going to be things like philanthropic trusts or foundations that are brought into it as well? And again, very good education tool, especially for younger generations. As long as the old generation accept that the need, that where that money may be donated to, as long as it's a DGR, designated gift recipient, sorry, as long as everyone understands that, the younger generations will have very different wants, needs, desires than the older generations. You know, one might be more towards, you know, assisting people in need versus the older generation probably could be more health oriented. So, yeah, these are things that have to be understood and sorted out. So it's the various entities, what goes in those various entities, the risk profile of these various entities, and also running this tax effectively. As I said before, you know, superannuation has some tax advantages over trusts, so making sure that we've got the right assets and the right vehicles. And therefore, it's looked at on a consolidated basis, but some of the entities may look different when you look at them standalone. But we, but as I said, it's also, at the moment, we're all up in the air on superannuation.
Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organisation Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now. And so once you've got a good understanding of their risk profiles and you've had sufficient interactions together to decide yep. whether or not you're for them and they're for you, then what needs to happen?
We put this investment proposal forward. One thing I forgot to say, are there any values that the family want taken into account as well in selecting the assets? So we put this to them. Then we have a chat with them. This chat is, you know, it's admitted when you've sat down with a client for couple of hours, that's all you know, that you don't know each other very well. So you're putting a proposal forward on how this is going to look. This is a first cut.
Yeah.
You know, there's likes and dislikes, and families have, you know, property assets. You know, they might have large industrial holdings. So we've got to adjust property, for instance. They may have other things outside this pool of money. Again, no two clients are the same. Some of these things come out in this meeting, even though we've tried to drag them out in the initial meeting, it's amazing the things that come out as you go along this journey. And as this is coming out, yeah, definitely going to be a second cut of this, so to speak, if not a third, as you go along. A client will decide, yes, they're going to go with you if they do believe you're the right fit, but also if they think they can trust you. Trust takes years. As I said, it's the number two. This client last night's 4 points. But, you know, trust does take years. So the when a client says, yes, we are going to go ahead, it's because they think they can trust you.
Yeah. Yeah, they're taking a punt, but you both are.
Yeah, we are.
And it won't be on the successes that trust is built. It's actually when the things get rough.
Correct.
And then we see how people behave. So we've now gotten to the point where they think that they trust you, and you've discovered that actually, yes, I did have an industrial holding that they'd forgot to mention, and that obviously changes the scenario.
Yeah.
And then you realise that actually they're very, very enthusiastic about philanthropic contributions to support people in need, and you agree on a plan. Then what happens?
The implementation is not, you know, somebody commits a dollar, you don't go and invest a dollar. So first of all, we've got to, you know, naturally open account, but we try to make that as painless as possible by working with clients, accountants and lawyers. So we do all the paperwork, but signatures are required. Then it's about the implementation strategy. And if somebody's committed to a certain amount, that can take years. You know, let's look at equity markets. You know, just this year, we've got a graph that we show people of what's happened since Trump has come in. And it's, in my 40 years in markets, it's probably been the noisiest 12 months I've ever seen. You know, who would have thought that on the 2nd of April, the market would have fallen 10% on the threat of tariffs?
Yeah.
And here we are with the market up, you know, 30% since then on the reality of 15% tariffs. It fell on 10% tariffs. Now we're on the reality of 15%. However, the minute we saw that reversal of some of these statements by the president on the 8th of April, we did actually put some money in on the 9th. And that's one of the things, so especially for new money, we did invest. However, you know, because we're a day after the announcement, it was up 8% that day. But we thought that, yeah, the bad news was over. And if you looked at the fear index, as we look at it, which CNN published, it was as bad as it got. And so that's why we had high confidence. So we do look at staggering money in. Defensive assets are a lot easier to put in. But when it comes to equity allocations, and actually, again, I'm traveling up from Melbourne to Sydney at the moment on a where I had that dinner with a client last night. I saw another client who is exactly in that place. We've only transitioned 1/3 of his equities, actually a quarter of his equity. And you know, we were talking about that next tranche, and I said, I don't know when that will be. You know, I really don't know. You know, things are frothy. They've done very well. But we like to invest at times of pain, which is also the hardest thing for a client, especially if they've got, they've realized the business and they've understood that risk of that business. And now they're going into something they may not quite understand the risks of.
Totally.
And like what we went through in April, you've got volatility and noise. That fear index was as extreme as it could get. And I'm saying, buy.
Mm.
That's where we've got to hold their hand. But they're the times when if you're looking to establish a long-term portfolio, you use those opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess the emphasis there is looking to establish a long-term portfolio. Yeah.
Right.
We're not really talking about active day trading.
No. If that's what we're wanting, we can refer people onto someone else. Yeah.
We're not placing bets for the next 24 hours. We're actually making investments for the next decade.
Correct. And markets, as I said, and markets go down as well as up. One thing what we run a portfolio on is we look at the downside participation. So we run a dummy portfolio, which we show prospective clients. And we actually did this to look at a lot of statistics, because we believe that I have this strong philosophy that long-term outperformance also comes from performing a lot better when markets fall. So less downside participation. Mm. So we look at volatility in our portfolios and then manage that to ensure that when the times get rough, the portfolio bends, it doesn't break, and we outperform. Now, Zenith managed this for, we give them the buy-sell recommendations that we're doing in a dummy portfolio, that the Zenith then compare this for us against the benchmarks. So if someone had just invested in benchmarks and a pool of competitors, we don't know who they are. We suddenly realized, we're not doing too badly at all. So we now actually use this as a marketing tool, not nearly 9 years later, because we've been doing this for 9 years. However, I will say, one thing I say to clients is, or prospective clients, our service is about keeping wealthy people wealthy.
Yeah.
We outperform on the downside. We do as well, if not a bit better, in a normal market. But when things get frothy, this is the time when you're probably going to do a little bit less. A little bit worse with us. We're just not going to participate to the same extent. So I'll give you an example. At the moment, we're seeing a case of, whilst all markets are going up, everything's being lifted by a high tide, the US market has earnings momentum behind it. And that's why it's rising. Right? Yeah. So if you look at a graph of the market and you look at earnings are shaped, the jaws are widening a little bit, and that's because the market's outperforming pace of the earnings. If you look at the Australian market, earnings are declining, but the market's going up.
Mm-hmm.
So you've actually got these terrible jaws where the earnings in the Australian market are decreasing. One of the reasons being is the high weighting of our banks.
Yeah.
And yet the banks have got 0.5% historical earnings per share growth. So there's that. And the composition of our index is also, it's very old. Resources or materials is another component. So the earnings on the ASX are declining. As such, and given the strong outperformance of the banks, whilst their earnings weren't there, we've gone slightly underweight Australian equity. So we look at a strategic benchmark for every client. And then markets, the fact of life is they go up, they go down. We then take a tactical view against those strategic benchmarks. And one of the reasons, and people search my name in the Australian, you'll see that I wrote an article on why we've gone underweight Australian equities. Mm-hmm. It's a marginal underweight, but it's the reality, and that's how we look at things, because the market's going up, but the earnings profile of the whole index is going down. Now, I think therefore, and also we look at, we use an economics group called Capital Economics in London. Their view on the Australian index is going sideways for the next 2 years, which I talk about in this article.
Right.
So I think that at an index level, the Australian market is not going anywhere, but there is the chance to make money because you will get rotation within the market. So for instance, if interest rates are going down, 47% of mid caps in Australia are on variable interest rates.
Yeah.
That's an opportunity.
Yeah. Mm. So this then becomes a dynamic relationship with your clients, but you're not in each other's pockets every 5 minutes.
So it's a very good point. So our asset allocation, we're sitting here today in early September. We've made two major changes to asset allocation this year.
Right.
And you know, whilst markets become expensive. So we've sailed with markets, but there came a point where we made some adjustments. And we like to meet with our clients, you know, 2 to 4 times a year, depending on what they would like. On there, it's holding ourselves to account. It's talking about our views going forward, but any changes don't come through meetings unless they're giving us, you know, more money, or they need some money taken out, or there's some change in their life they hadn't communicated. These tactical asset allocation changes occur. You know, I might get off this call and, you know, our asset allocation consultant may have made a change, and that's when we start communicating with clients, when we've discussed it and we need to make those changes. Now, beginning of 2022, I'll give you an example. We came into markets and we were overweight. Suddenly, you saw the Fed, you know, talking about tightening. You saw the conflict break out with Ukraine. We went underweight in February. So that year, and it occurred mainly in the first half, we made 8 changes to asset allocation as we took risk off the table and went defensive. Now, that's an example of at an extreme level. So what we do is we communicate with clients. If it's, you know, the majority of them come back very quickly via email. If not, some of them ring us and want to have a discussion about it, and then we follow up. And that's if for those that happen to, you know, people travel, people are overseas. I had an email overnight from a guy who's, sorry, I didn't get back to you. I'm in Portugal, but please go ahead by doing something. So yeah, we do follow these up. Yeah. So it's not we're on the phone every day, but we're there for our clients when they need it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so, Will, you're a medium business.
Yeah.
How have you applied this to your business and your family? What's helped to put you in a sound position for the future?
I invest exactly the same way as our clients do. And in fact, I actually don't do it myself. I get one of the other guys to do it because in our team, so I can say I invest alongside you, I invest the same way, but I have biases. And like everybody.
So you're just human, are you, Will? Jeez.
That's better if I'm not. I'd get somebody in the team to oversee running that money the way the firm does, rather than me sort of, oh, well, maybe we overinvest in this one or not as much in that one. So, yes, the situation of plumber's pipes, I think, is real for everybody.
So, Will, you know, when it comes to choosing an advisor and managing a significant sum, what do you see as being the gotchas? What can go wrong as we embark on this path?
The big thing on this is about, as I said to you before, choosing somebody who you think you can work with. And we're right for some people and we're not right for others. Sure. I've explained what we do and how we do it. If somebody's wanting, I can remember saying to one client one time, he told me he's splitting the money between us and someone else. And I said, okay. And a lot of clients do that. So nothing wrong, but I just wanted to know who and why. And I actually recommended that he give 100% of the money to them. I said, if that's where you're going, we're going to frustrate you. We're boring, right? And it's got to be the right fit. It really does have to be the right fit. And if it's not the right fit, it's, you know, one, if we take on somebody who's not right for us, it's not going to work. And so I have to be honest with clients as well. And they've got to be honest with us. And, you know, as I said, we're about keeping wealthy people wealthy. And I make no bones about it. We're boring. And if somebody's wanting something, we're about running money for people that have realized an asset and have made that wealth. And therefore, they want to be sent. It's not about making that next fortune. That's what you're wanting. I'm not the person for you, and it's not going to work.
And I think that is so important. You know, I have exactly the same approach with my client selection to ensure that we are in alignment from a values perspective, an objectives and an outcome perspective, and also a speed perspective. Quite often come across clients that want to 10x their business in 12 months. And there's a reality check there. And I'm not the person to support them on that. And I certainly won't support them if they're frankly deluded and unrealistic. I'd rather tell them up front that that's potentially a fool's errand. And that makes it easy for both of us then to figure out whether we should work together or not. What are the other areas that can go wrong as we go down this path?
Well, the other thing is, as we explained to people, is asset location is the most important thing. And if people consider this and take the right
advice. You said location or allocation?
No. Asset location.
Yes.
So have they got the right again, I was talking about getting sale ready, but then it's about investing. Have you got the right entities for investing as well? So have you got the right advice on that as well? Because it's very expensive if you go down one route, but suddenly, maybe this isn't the right, most tax effective way, and you've got to unwind things, and you might have inherent CGT in there. So getting that right from day one is absolutely crucial. And that's where we like to work with a client's accountant to make sure that those vehicles, that asset location is, everyone's on the same map with respect to that. You know, there's a lots of things, you know, you're the accountant, you know, Division 7A, there's lots of things that, you know, suddenly come out along the way, and it's, yeah, that can be very costly.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au.
Well, final question. If a founder or a CEO is looking at the proceeds from their exit or has amassed significant investable assets, what critical few actions should they do tomorrow if they did nothing else?
I think that then don't just go and lock it in a term deposit. A lot of people just say, I've got a term deposit for 12 months. I think keep some flexibility and start doing your homework. I think that's the, as I said, you know, we can be right for people and we're not the right team for some others. Likewise, other firms are the same thing. So the thing is, start doing that homework and make sure you set up. And, you know, we've talked about these things along the line of, which are really crucial with respect to asset location, things like that. So make sure that's all established and do that homework. And if it takes time, it takes time. Don't be in a hurry. But at the same time, don't just go and lock it away for 12 months. And I think it's, yeah, if there's family involved, make sure you've got the family involved in some of these decisions. And do you need to bring other experts in to help you resolve some of the things that, yeah, you know, the family need to be involved in? So these are the things that, as I said, it takes time, but have a checklist to make sure you go through, am I selecting the right firm? Make sure that you're going to do that. Likewise, other advisors that are necessary. And that firm that you select might have some, you know, like what we call wealth planning. So we bring in succession experts, governance if it's required in running that money. What are the wants, desires, needs of the family? Do they want to go down the path of philanthropic pursuits as well with some of that money? And there's a tax advantage, you know, there's a tax angle to some of that, which you need to talk to your tax experts about as well. Absolutely. So as I said, there's a lot of conversations.
Yeah.
It's not simple.
Be prepared, but also be deliberate.
Yep.
There's no need for panic at this point.
Yeah.
Good.
Correct.
Fantastic, Will. As always, it's been a delight to chat with you. Thank you so much for your time.
No, thank you very much, John. I really appreciate it.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualized business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.